Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, let me start with Major League Baseball. So Major League Baseball postponed two games yesterday and then two more today in the wake of one third of the Miami Marlins roster testing positive for COVID. And this morning, Ken Rosenthal reported that the Marlins have four additional players test positive. So now we're at 15 that we know about. Half of a 30-man roster that we know about has tested positive. Now, you would think that in and of itself would be a total and complete nightmare. You would think that, but you'd be wrong. Because the commissioner told MLB Network last night that it's really not that bad at all.
I don't put this in the nightmare category. I mean, obviously, we don't want any player to get exposed. It's not a positive thing, but I don't see it as a nightmare.
My man, you don't put that in the nightmare category. If that's not a nightmare, exactly what is a nightmare? Half the clubhouse has tested positive for COVID. How is that not in the nightmare category? And if it's not, man, exactly how horrible are your dreams? MLB spent the last four plus months, coming up with a plan for dealing with COVID and then didn't even make it out of the first weekend without having to cancel games because of COVID. And this guy is all up in here saying, nope, we're good. We're cool. It's all good. Nothing to see here. Just keep moving. Like that meme of that dog sitting in the room that's on fire drinking hot coffee thinks that you're in denial, Rob. Yet the commissioner had more.
We built the protocols to allow us to continue to play. That's why we have the expanded rosters. That's why we have the pool of additional players. And we think we can keep people safe and continue to play.
You mean like not only is this not a nightmare, it's actually a positive? Like this is really a good thing? And how about him going to the that's why we have the expanded rosters argument as to why this is not a problem? Dude, the issue is not the size of the roster. The issue is the fact that half the roster has COVID. Oh, but stay out of the commissioner's way. He's going to go with that glass is half full view. He's practically saying, I mean, yeah, sure, half the roster has COVID, but what about the other half that haven't tested positive? And what about the fact that the guys who do have the virus are actually now creating opportunities for minor leaguers to get a chance to live out their dream of playing professional baseball? Damn, man. Not only do we not have a problem, we are making dreams come true. How can that be a nightmare? Man, why do you all have to be so negative? When did you all become Team COVID? Hey, look, I don't want to tell anybody. I don't want anybody to tell me how to do my job. So far be it for me to tell the commissioner of Major League Baseball how to do his job, but he clearly needs some help doing his job. So I'm here to give it to him. Listen up, Robbie. The issue is not the roster size. The issue is that you had a team with four known positive tests playing on Sunday. Then by Monday, they had 13 positive tests between players and coaches. Now we're up to 17 total that we know about. That's the issue. That's the problem. And yes, that is a major freaking problem. And a major freaking problem that there really was not a protocol for postponing a game when the team had numerous positive tests. How was there not a plan in place? How was there not a protocol? How was that game played? And then there is the line of, quote, we think we can keep people safe and continue to play, end quote. Huh? Did you not see the news? A third of the roster of a team just tested positive on Monday and four more this morning. So exactly how are you keeping people safe? Tom Verducci asked the commissioner what it would take to shut down a team or a season completely.
A team losing a number of players that rendered it completely non-competitive would be an issue that we would have to address and have to think about making a change. Whether that was shutting down a part of the season, the whole season, that depends on the circumstances. Same thing with respect to league-wide. You know, you get to a certain point league-wide where it does become a health threat, and we certainly would shut down at that point.
Again, if a third of the roster testing positive is not enough, what is? Where is the line? Is half the roster the line? Is it when you no longer have nine guys to play? But then again, knowing this crew, they just take those cardboard cutouts from the stands, tape gloves to their faces, and slap them in at third base and shortstop. Or just start grabbing guys off the street to play. If anyone listening has ever wanted to play pro baseball, it sounds like all you have to do is show up to Marlins Park with a glove, stand outside, wear a mask, of course, and you've got a damn good chance of getting into a game. But don't worry, MLB's got it all under control. In the wake of this outbreak in the Marlins clubhouse, the league does have a plan. Scott Miller tweeted, quote, "The commission office will redouble health directives, e.g., players must wear masks in clubhouses and reinforce on-field behavior prohibitions against high-fiving and spitting." End quote. Translation, the Marlins have half their roster test positive for COVID, and MLB is going to crack down on high-fives and spitting. Man, that is hilarious. Hilarious. Like one of the most MLB things ever. I'd be laughing if it was not happening during a global pandemic. Man, COVID is going through the Marlins clubhouse like a hot knife through butter. And what does the commissioner do? He cracks down on high fives and spitting. Yeah, I'm sure when the league office came up with that solution, they all were really happy with themselves. Probably gave themselves a raise because of all the great work. COVID crisis? Hey, man, I got your answer. Ban high fives. Problem solved. Dodge that bullet. Now back to our other awesome idea of putting a runner on second base in extra innings. Man, who's got it better than us? Nobody! Hey, listen. Listen. I hope you really do have it under control. I really hope that this nightmare, this non-nightmare start to your season is just that. It's just a nightmare and somehow it's the worst moment of the entire year, and we'll all look back on it in a few months and think, damn, that was crazy, right? Man, that was wild. I really hope that cracking down on high fives and spitting does work. Except I've got to say, my confidence right about now in MLB and their protocols is pretty low. They had all this time to come up with all these protocols, and they still did not make it out of the first weekend without a complete nightmare. And I have to ask the question, if baseball couldn't do it without a bubble, where the hell does that leave the NFL? We are joined by John Rahm. John, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here again. Thank you very much. I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good, John. Great to hear your voice. All right, so as I mentioned off the very top, you won the Memorial just over a week ago. So when you think back on that tournament, immediately what comes to mind and what are your biggest takeaways from that win?
Oh, it's arguably the biggest individual win in my career so far. You know, I hadn't been able to win a big event in the U.S. Since Torrey. So to win a Jack Nicklaus's tournament with the legacy and the history he has, right? One of the bigger or the best PGA Tour fields ever assembled. And with how difficult it was played, it almost had a sense of major championship golf. Not completely right, but almost had a sense of it. So being able to get that done and to play as good as I did was obviously very important for me. So I'm really proud of the whole week, and that'll be the takeaway, right? It's just being able to get it done on a big stage finally.
World number one, John Rahm, is joining us. You know, you mentioned Jack. Of course, you won the Jack Nicklaus Award when you were at Arizona State. You've said that when you were at Oakmont, you got a chance to pick his brain a little bit. What did you take away from that particular conversation?
I got to pick his brain at the award ceremony 4 years ago. And the takeaway I had is that golf courses have changed a lot since 1962. That's the takeaway I got, because he gave me the advice of not being scared of putting downhill at Oakmont, which he might have worked when he won there. But when we played close to 60 years afterwards, it was not the best thing. Those greens were impossible to putt on, right? Much like almost that event we played a couple weeks ago, putting downhill and firm and fast greens is not easy. So he still gave me, you know, just believe in yourself. That's basically what he told me. You don't need anything special. Just believe in yourself and play your golf and be yourself. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since.
This episode is brought to you by Fracture. Fracture turns your digital images into beautiful glass prints. That's right. They print your photos directly on glass, transforming your memories into handcrafted, frameless prints. absolutely gorgeous. Beautiful thing to have. Fracture helps you focus on the moments that matter most by turning those favorite memories into beautiful glass prints. Fracture prints directly on durable glass with soft edges for safe handling. And every print comes with a 100% happiness guarantee. If for any reason you do not absolutely love that print, Fracture will make it right. Fracture prints look incredible. You really need to see them to believe it. Upload your photo at fractureme.com/Rome to print your photo today on glass. And we've got a special deal for you listeners. When you visit fractureme.com/Rome and you enter the promo code Rome, you'll get 20% off your order. That's fractureme.com/Rome. Enter the promo code Rome and save 20% off your Fracture glass print. I'm hyped on Fracture, and I do appreciate their sponsorship of this podcast. I'm talking to John Rahm. You know, John, if we were to go back to the week before the Memorial, in that final round of the Workday Charity at Muirfield Village, you bogeyed the first hole, and then you shot 9-under the rest of the way. Did you find something that round that carried over to Memorial?
A little bit, yes. I had just changed my irons, a couple of things with my irons, and there was a little bit of adjusting to get into that, and that Sunday gave me a lot of confidence that things were working, and the confidence to know that I can play good on that golf course. I can shoot low on that golf course. Now, truth be told, you played extremely different to what it did from that Sunday, but just having some positive visuals into some of the shots and some of the holes obviously helps out a lot, right? So it's always, you know, better for your mindset to go into the next tournament knowing that your last round was really good over there. So it did help out a lot.
We're talking to John Rahm. You know, John, you mentioned also the third round at the Memorial was one of the best rounds of your entire life, and that final round certainly had some clutch up and downs. It included that flop shot on 16, which was absolutely perfect. You know, it turns out the ball had moved ever so slightly when you addressed the ball, but still an absolutely amazing shot. What do you remember about that moment?
I remember hitting it left and being on that spot and hoping to maybe give myself a chance for par, right? I was aware Ryan Palmer could chip it in, and it could be a two-shot swing. So my mindset was, well, you know, try to hit it close, but not, you know, don't leave it in the rough. That was the only concern I had. But then I just decided to be a little bit more aggressive. What I mean aggressive is maybe just pick a tighter spot closer to the edge of the green, knowing that I could actually give myself close to a tap in for par. And then when he came out, it was absolutely perfect. Once I saw it land what it did, I was like, well, okay, I'm going to have it say 3 feet for par, and then started tracking. And well, I don't know if I ever let myself believe it was going to go in, cause it went in on the low side, but man, you know, the contact, the swing through, and when it landed, I knew at least I had a par. So it was pretty, you know, pretty good feeling to be able to do that a couple of times, especially on the last few holes, right? Finished with four straight up and downs for par to win the tournament was you know, something I hadn't had to do before, and I'm glad I did, because, you know, I had had my nerves under control in the rough.
John Rahm, I guess so. It's not only the win, it's how you won it, and of course it made you the number one golfer in the world. Now, you had said that you made a deal with yourself. I'm fascinated by this story. You made a deal with yourself when you were young, maybe around the age of 13 or 14, that you would start working towards being the number one player in the world, and now you've done just that. So now that you've achieved the goal, does it feel the way you thought that it would?
Nope. I think a lot of people have success the length of how long success lasts in your mind. I've been maybe a little bit confused, and that was one of those. I thought when I got here, it was going to last forever. And yeah, I won the tournament. I got the number one in the world, and that lasted maybe about 10 seconds. And
wow.
Then it's like, well, now what, right? I've heard of many athletes falling into some depression, you know, like Olympians falling into depression after the Olympic Games, or a lot of them in situations like that, and they can understand why. I mean, you put so much work into something like that. You put a lot of hours, and the vulnerability that we have when we're out there, because we're playing with all our emotions, our passion for everybody to see, right? I can understand why some people fall into depression afterwards. So I enjoyed it. It was really, really fun. And again, maybe I said 10 seconds, it's a little bit of exaggeration, but a lot of people that get into a situation like this in their career, I think they're not done, right? And I'm certainly not done. I don't know if I'll be able to stay here for a long time, but certainly that's the goal, right? I got a lot more to accomplish in mind. So hopefully I can keep just doing that.
It's a really thoughtful response to that sense, and you're right. I've talked to a lot of guys, John, that when they chase something long enough and they finally get there, it isn't necessarily what they thought it would be, and then once you get there, you have to find a way to manage it. Now, you are the second golfer from Spain to be ranked number one in the world. The first, of course, is the legend, Seve Ballesteros. So what does he mean to you, and then what's it mean to you to hear your name mentioned along with his?
I think tied with the question before, we can all learn from Kobe, right? You got to learn how to enjoy the process each and every day, and that's an important part. Seve is a huge influence in my career, and I think a lot of people in Spain and Europe. Golf in Spain wasn't huge up until he showed up and did what he did. And the reason my family plays golf, my dad started, is because of the Ryder Cup that happened in Spain in 1997, which Seve was captain, right? That week was very special for the whole country. And he started playing golf because of that. And I am here because of that. And, you know, hadn't been no Seve, probably there'd be no John Rahm. And to think that I'm here now because of him and what he did only makes me think that hopefully I can keep growing the game in Spain and throughout the world. And somebody who gets the number one in the world at some point or to play great golf and be on the tour say that they're here because of me. And that'll be a huge honor. I love the history of the game. And I respect everybody that came here before me. And yeah, hopefully I can live, me and my generation can basically elevate the level of golf and have a better path for the people coming after us. And that'll be my biggest goal out of all.
Got another moment or two with John Rahm. John, I've got to ask about this too. You told Rich Lerner of the Golf Channel earlier this year that when it comes to Seve, quote, to be that charismatic, to have that aura, I mean, basically the Ryder Cup is what it is thanks to him. You know, the short game, the creativity, the unlikeliness of that game to make it and to be an open champion and to actually become a major champion. The defiance of the odds is pretty impressive, end quote. I love that line about the creativity and the unlikeliness of his game. Like, is that something you can learn from, or is that something that is just purely Seve?
Well, the way he did it, it was purely Seve. I mean, his first major championship win Lytham, he did not hit a single fairway on the back nine and somehow managed to shoot on the par. It's impressive. That it's very unlikely for anybody to do that, especially in that day and age, right? Somebody that's known for being erratic on the off the tee to win where you probably need to be most accurate of the tee. It's incredible. He was something special, right? And it's unlikely. I mean, you have sometimes the way you are, your physical attributes and the way you play dictate the way you're going to do things in a sport. And always, you know, people that have changed the sport are always a little bit different. But it's very unique, you know, the way he grew up, the way he got into the game of golf, how hard it was for him to have a spot in Spain to be able to play golf, knowing where he came from, and from there to take it what he did, it's very, very special. That's where I said, you know, thanks to him, it was so easy for people like me to start playing golf and the accessibility to the game of golf. So that's why I say the unlikeliness, right? Son of a farmer, they didn't have much money. They were just caddies, not even allowed to play on the golf course. He grew up learning with a 3-iron out of all things that his brothers found. And just all of those things added, and to see what he accomplished afterwards, man, it's really, really, really impressive. So not that I'm ever going to do anything close to what he did, because Seve was one, and I don't think there'll be anybody like him again. But hopefully I can do something similar. And if you take the way we both grew up learning the game, you would say somebody like me would be much more likely to accomplish something in golf than him, right? Especially at that age. But the one thing you can't measure is what's in somebody's mind. And he was gifted in that sense. So hopefully I can just follow his steps little by little and accomplish some of the things he was able to do.
Beautiful mind, right? John, one last thought. When you and I spoke last year, we talked about your love of hip-hop. Who are you listening to these days?
Well, the latest album of Juice WRLD, R.I.P., right? I think he was working on this album right before he passed away, and his new songs are, you know, it's really, really good. It explains a lot of what was going through his mind. So people that like that type of music, and he's also a singer, so I think a lot more people would enjoy that album.
He is the world number one. He is a Ryder Cup winner, and we have the WGC FedEx St. Jude's Invitational getting underway on Thursday. John, so good to visit with you. I appreciate the relationship, and that's a great conversation once again. John, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
I said it here yesterday. Let me say it again right now. Lou Williams is a legend. Winning 3 6th Men of the Year awards is elite. right? It's an amazing accomplishment, really. But hitting up Magic City Gentlemen's Club when you're out of the NBA bubble is next level. And then saying that you went there because of the wings is next level 2.0. And then being right and truthful about saying that you were in a strip club during a pandemic for the wings is full on mind-blowing. Not only did he do it, not only did he say it, but it was true. Lou Williams stopping off at Magic City Gentlemen's Club for, quote, Lou Will Lemon Pepper Barbecue Wings is maybe the greatest moment in NBA history. It's not a hot take. I'm not trying to stir the pot. I mean that. That might be the single greatest moment in NBA history. In fact, why stop there? That might be the single greatest moment in world history. That good. It just doesn't get any better. It does not get any more legendary. It doesn't get any more iconic. Oh, yes, it does. Hell yes, it does. Because yesterday, Kendrick Perkins took a foolhardy run at Lou Williams on TV. Because you got to feed the beast, right? You got to bring the content. You got to say something. You got to get people to look at you and react to you. So that's what he did. And then retweeted a clip of the segment with the caption, quote, "It's disturbing when a rookie in Zion Williamson can act more mature than NBA vet Lou Williams," end quote. All right, so really quickly, it's one thing to say it on TV, and it's another thing to say the exact same thing on Twitter. These are different rooms. These are different platforms. They hit differently. And they'll find the source differently. And let me say this about Perk. I like Kendrick Perkins. I used to love having him on the show back in the day. I used to love talking to him on this show back in the day. He always struck me as a guy that was interesting. Interesting player, interesting person, wouldn't hold back in a world where oftentimes guys have nothing to say. He always had something to say. And as a talk show host, you know I like that. Having said all that, the last thing anybody should be doing is taking a run at Lou Williams on Twitter. Even Perk. Because Lou will clap back. He'll clap right back. You should never come for Lou on Twitter at any time. But especially right now, because my guy is sitting in quarantine. All my guy has now is time. He's got time, he's got Twitter digits, and he's got a phone, and he's not afraid to use it. So, Perk takes a run at Lou, and Lou had a little something for Perk. And I quote, 15 years in this business, and the most dirt you have on my name is stopping to get hot wings during a pandemic. Perk, shut up and stop laughing and saying it's just TV when you run into me too. End tweet. Boom! That was such a good tweet. Twitter can be fierce. Twitter can be idiotic. But I'm here to tell you that is a hell of a tweet. Every part of that tweet is great. That first sentence, 15 years in this business and the most dirt you have on my name is stopping to get hot wings during a pandemic. You want to print that, you want to frame that, you want to hang that up on a wall, and you want to shellac it to a piece of wood because that ain't coming down. That is an incredible sentence. I've been around for a decade and a half, and the worst thing you can say about me is that I stopped off to get hot wings during a pandemic. That's your hot take, that I got hot wings? That's all you got? That's the most dirt you've got? Man, keep moving. But it gets better. Like, in and of itself, that would have been strong. But it gets even better. Then you've got a sentence that is just Perk. He just hit him with a Perk. Nickname, period.
Period.
Perk. And they follow that up with, shut up. Nickname, period. Shut up, period. In other words, Perk.
Please.
Shut up. That is so good.
Period.
The only thing more outstanding than Perk. Shut up, in my opinion, would have been, shut up, Perk. Still good. I mean, again, I'm not going to tell. I don't want anybody telling me how to tweet, and far be it for me to tell Lou how to tweet. Perk, shut up, is incredible. Shut up, Perk, would have been better. But then you come to the final sentence, which is the real hammer. Quote, and stop laughing and saying just TV, it's just TV when you run into me too. In other words, man, be real. I mean, Perk of all things would be the first one to tell everybody else to be real, right? Lou's saying, man, be real. Don't say this bull bleep on TV and then laugh it off when we're face to face and say it was just a show and you were just performing for the camera. Man, don't be a clown. Be real about it. If you're going to say it and mean it and then own it when you see me. But don't be two-faced. That is such a great tweet. And then he followed that up with another tweet. Lou said, quote, but I digress. I went home to see a man off to his final resting place that was a giant in my life. I don't want that to get lost in all this attention. So again, long live the great Paul Williams Sr. Back to my quarantine so I can join the guys soon. Peace. End quote. But it wasn't over because Montrezl Harrell came rushing in from the locker room to join the fight. He was the third man in. He tweeted, quote, big Perk. What you not gone do is talk wild to the OG when you don't got all the facts. End quote. And that's what a teammate does. That's what a teammate's for. You have your guys back in a fight, even if it's on Twitter. And Montrezl is the kind of teammate that you want in a situation like that. He's coming in, and he's ready to lay down the law for Perk. Except Williams was not only fighting Perk, he had other people coming for him. There was one rando on Twitter who tweeted, quote, I can't believe Lou Williams went to the strip club, during the restart. To which Lou responded with, quote, cuz you never been to one a day in your life? LOL.
Laugh out loud.
Well played, Lou. Then there was a tweet that he received that read, quote, you're getting on my very last nerve. This is not about you or your damn wings. It's about every single player you put at risk because of your actions. Stop tweeting, for heaven's sake, and do better. Williams responded with, quote, you can be quiet as well. I got tested every day I was home. I also had a mandatory quarantine upon returning to campus. Regardless, that's the protocol. So you stop tweeting. End quote. Like, yes, I went to a gentleman's club for wings during a pandemic, but I followed testing protocol. So you stop tweeting. Look, here's one thing I do know. The one thing I do know in all of this, I don't want Lou to stop tweeting. In fact, I want him tweeting even more because as great as this story was, it's getting better with every single tweet. I would say come at this guy or go at this guy at your own risk, but I'm not going to say anything at all because I want more people going at this guy because he's got a lot of time on his hands. He's got some Twitter fingers. He's got a phone. He's not afraid to use it. And that went badly for Perk. We are joined by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, always good to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. Always good to talk to you.
Great to have you. Now, Bruce, before I get into your annual freaks list, I want to get your sense as to how people around the world of college football reacted when they saw the story, Bruce, involving all the positive tests with the Miami Marlins.
You know, it got a lot of people's attention. Now, some of the ADs in the Power Five we spoke to said, you know what, we expected some of this. But I think the idea that, look, this is a sport in baseball where there's more social distancing in terms of it. It's not like football. You have much smaller rosters. And as a football coach put it to me when he saw this story, it was like, well, you know what? They're professionals. We're not. So the optics aren't great. But hopefully that Major League Baseball can keep having a season. And then I think right now college football is trying at best they can to make a run at having a season as well. But obviously this is one of the things that is on their radar to see how is other sports going to make it work. It's not an apples to apples comparison, but it's definitely something that got people's attention and they're monitoring it.
Bruce Feldman's joining us. I mean, not only are they trying to make the season work still yet, college football, but even some are trying to make it work on time. As you've written, for instance, in the case of Oklahoma and Kansas, they've decided to open up their season against Missouri State and Southern Illinois on August 29th. What was the thinking behind those moves, and does that still make sense at this point?
I think it gives them some added flexibility in terms of what could happen, stretching out a season. It's one more week. So I think that's the thinking behind it. Now, look, I've talked to some ADs and some coaches who are looking at it going, you know what? We feel like we have a little bit of understanding, a better understanding now of how this virus is, how we can manage it a little better. Our players now, after being around the program for close to a month, they probably take it more seriously now because they've seen some of the, you know, how it can spread, not necessarily in the program, but certainly, you know, a bunch of guys got together and played Madden, or somebody went over to a pool party, and then all of a sudden that's how the cases piled up. And so when you talk to people in a lot of college football, their big concerns are what happens when the rest of the student body comes back and campuses get filled up. And those students probably aren't going to take it as seriously as maybe the people now around college football are. Will there be a surge at that point starting in late August? And I think that's something that is concerning. And also that, you know, I've heard a bunch is, it's also, you have some older staff and some coaches who could be at risk too. And so I think there's a lot of stuff right now that they're trying to sort out.
We're talking to Bruce Feldman. You know, Bruce, that point about the students and when they return, it was not that long ago that some of the sport were saying that if the students are not on campus, then athletes should not be either, and there should not be sports. In other words, if it's not safe for the students, then it's not safe for the student athletes. Is that, and as you're pointing out, there are people talking about this still yet, is that still the case, or has that been modified a bit, that take?
I think it's been modified some. Look, you can be cynical. You don't have to be too cynical to say, look, sounds like they're moving the goalposts. But I think there's also an element, and I don't think this is insignificant. There's a lot of people in college sports leadership who are going to make the argument and say, look, they're probably more safer in our structure that we have in our college programs than they may be at home in terms of you know, there's a lot of elements to this. It's not so cut and dry. And I think one thing you will hear a lot, probably more, is there's going to be a bunch of places that are going to say, hey, you know what? It's probably better for you to take classes online, not be around as much of the student body. It's not necessarily the closest thing they could probably get to creating their own bubble in college athletics. Now, I don't think every program can have all their college football players take online classes, but I think you will probably see that encouraged by a lot more people, at least inside the program, for that, because I think they're really worried about the risks of being around other students. And it's, you know, it's one of these things where I think, again, the optics of this are not great as you laid it out. And I think right now it's just between the financial impact, and I think there's also a mental health component that if you talk to people inside college athletics, that I think is a real thing about not having the structure that comes with it. It's not just, hey, it's all about the money. And no doubt that is a big part of this. But I think there's a lot of stuff that people are trying to sort out. In addition to a lot of the players, they do want to play. And so how do you kind of balance this with a very real problem as a pandemic that they've never dealt with before, anything like it, quite honestly.
Bruce Feldman's joining us. The Freaks List is out on the Athletic site. I will get to that momentarily. Bruce, what about this notion that, I mean, programs obviously are taking steps to minimize contact between players during workouts, but the fact is football is a contact sport. At some point, you're going to have to start making contact with your teammates in practice and opponents during games. How do you expect teams to deal with this?
That is the hardest thing, because right, that's the hardest thing to gauge, because at this point, till Friday, they had only done works out in small groups. Now they're able to do the 20-hour rule kicked in, so they can have up to 6 hours of walkthroughs where they're on a field. Now, most teams are going to have players wear masks. It is not high-speed football. It's walkthroughs, and it's going to be in smaller groups, not necessarily the whole team. But what does that translate to, right? And I think the concern is if you have, let's say, a couple of cases that end up getting inside your program and you have, you know, an offensive lineman or a defensive lineman, I mean, they're up against the same player for roughly 3 hours in the app, you know, in a game or however many reps at practice. Is that the way things can spread? You know, it's so hard to predict right now, but I think, again, this is way different than golf and the PGA. And quite honestly, it's way different than MLB because of that nature. Now, the reality is a lot of these cases seem like they have been spread because of guys, you know, people hanging out in more social settings, and it's probably indoors where some of the problems have happened. But I think this is something where, you know, right now, once they get out and do actual football stuff, that is something I've had several coaches go, I don't know what's going to happen when we start doing 9-on-7 drill. I mean, there's only so much, you know, you can't really manage social distancing the same way. And so it's, you know, the best right now, the best thing everybody can do is kind of speculate and say what we're going to see and see what happens. And obviously a bunch of other levels of football, whether it's the junior colleges or FCS or, you know, Division II schools have said, you know what, that's a risk we're not willing to take.
Bruce Feldman joining me. Bruce, you brought up a really interesting point that I want to ask you about. One last thought about the virus. You've addressed the idea of a backup head coach, the person who would take over if the head coach tests positive for COVID. What is your sense as to how many programs already had that person in place and have already made that decision?
I would say, and I, you know, we did this story on The Athletic late last week, and I talked to, I don't know, probably 20 staffs about that. And I think there's something in place, but it's not as simple as, oh, that guy's, you know, going to be a head coach down the road or something. It was like what I had heard a lot of is, what's the best way we can keep everything kind of on track for a two-week stretch? This is kind of different than if you have an interim head coach taking over at the end of a season or something, where they're saying is like, we want our coordinators to be able to try to at best keep doing their job. Because at some point, you're also going to have a lot of feedback, you would think, even if a head coach is quarantined. I mean, it's not like he's going to, you know, it's not like a player who just got ejected from a game for targeting. So I think it's a very different dynamic. And so when you started to pose that question, it was interesting because I had a bunch of coaches, head coaches themselves, who were like, you know, we've thought about it and kind of walked down the road, but it's a new problem to have to figure out. Now, a bunch of them have figured out what their play calling structure is on that side of the ball or on offense or defense or how, you know, there's a little bit of a chain of command. But it's definitely, you know, it's got people thinking in different ways. I'll be honest, after hearing some of the theories on what they think they would do.
Bruce Feldman joining us. All right, Bruce, the very popular freaks list is out on the Athletic site. The number one player on the list this year is Quiddy Pay, a defensive end from Michigan. What sets him apart from all the other freaks?
Crazy amount of change of direction, Jim. We're talking about a guy who's 271 pounds. And the shuttle times he's put up in their Michigan training system are that of a, not just a defensive back, but like a super fast defensive back. And this was a guy who, when he came to Michigan, had legit track credentials, was a state champion on the 4x100 relay team, won a state long jump title. He was 228 pounds when he showed up in Ann Arbor. Now he's 271. And one of the coaches there told me, remember, they had Rashawn Gary, who was this five-star, you know, great athlete. And they say Quiddy Pay has the best change of direction of any D lineman they've had there in a long time. And so if you're doing something that's even more impressive than Rashawn Gary athletically, that's really saying something.
All right, so number two on the list, Bruce, is Carlos Basham Jr., the defensive end at Wake Forest. And because he plays there, he may not have the national profile of some other guys on that list. So what is it that makes him so special?
So Boogie Basham for Wake Forest, now there's been a lot of big-time D linemen, you know, certainly from NC State and Clemson in the ACC. This is a guy the NFL scouts already really like. Now, he's 280 pounds, and what's crazy about him is, remember, like the original freak, Javon Kearse, was 20 pounds lighter, and this guy moves even better. I mean, that's crazy to say, but a short shuttle time, 4.21, that's faster than Javon Kearse did at 260 pounds. I mean, this guy is a great player on the field, and just ask anybody around the ACC country and they'll just rave about how good of a player. It's just he's, you know, a lot of ways he's been overshadowed by all the guys Clemson has.
Right, so the way you answered that and the way you mentioned Javon Kearse, it kind of leads me to my next question. You've been doing this list over the years. Are guys getting freakier from year to year, or do the freaks from the early years stack up pretty well with the freaks of 2020?
I think they still do. I mean, you know, Margus Hunt from SMU was a crazy, you know, freakish talent who was this European shot-putting star. I mean, you had guys like Adrian Peterson. Calvin Johnson was the guy I had one of the first years on my list. So those guys translate. I mean, the one thing is occasionally you will see somebody I have a guy this year on my list, Michael Martinez. He's a tight end from UCLA. He's 6'6", over 260. His hands are so much bigger than the biggest hands anybody's ever had measured at the combine. He has to be on the list, right? So it's like you had DeForest Buckner's hands were over 11 and a half inches, the biggest that they've been measured at the combine. This guy's hands are almost a full inch bigger.
Whoa.
You know, it's just crazy. So occasionally you will get a guy like that who is like, you know, even makes you say, wow, when the other freaks go, wow, that guy's a freak, that's telling you something.
See, that's something else. And that leads me to my final question. I mean, are freaks recruited or are they made? I mean, you can't teach what you just told me, that kind of hand size. But in other words, is the athlete doing the work? But how much of that, of showing up on that list, is about the strength and conditioning coaches and the programs that they design, as opposed to a guy who's just wired for it?
I think it's a combination. Look, Saquon Barkley is blessed in terms of his gifts and his work ethic. But, you know, I had four guys on there. I've never had four players from the same school on the list before till this year. I have four Penn State guys. And part of the reason why is the numbers are eye-popping. But I think another part of that is, if you look at what some of the, and Saquon is a good example, if you look at what some of the Penn State players have done, I mean, I've had a bunch of guys on the list before from Penn State in recent years, but then you see what they've done at the NFL Combine, and it's not just Saquon. It was Troy Apke, it was Mike Gesicki, it's been receivers. It's, you know, it's going to be Micah Parsons when he goes through there. It's going to be Jason Owe. It's going to be Journey Brown now. I mean, when you have players who back it up, and I think it helps when they have this competitive environment, and that's certainly a place that has it, where, okay, this is the program we're going to jump into, and then they see it. And I think when you see what a Saquon Barkley is doing, I think that forces everybody else, if they're competitive, to try to compete with it. And so I think that's part of the culture. But certainly, you know, you couldn't just take a man off the street and put him into a program and say, okay, you're going to do everything this guy does as hard as he does, as best you can. I mean, yes, you'll improve, but you're not going to do what some of these guys are doing. And it's just, I think that's what makes them, you know, so different than the average really good athlete.
Such good stuff with Bruce Feldman. He is a reporter for Fox Sports and FS1, a national college football insider for The Athletic. You can see that freaks list on that site. He is a New York Times bestselling author. And remember, his most recent book is The QB. Bruce, great job. Great to have you back. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Meantime, we've been talking about Major League Baseball, the COVID outbreak in the Marlins clubhouse, whether or not that's a big deal. The commissioner seems to think that's not a big deal at all. And then we get word this morning that the Nationals have voted not to go to play the Marlins this weekend. But Major League Baseball ultimately will make the final decision. Again, let me stress, the commissioner has been saying this is not in the nightmare category. Let me go back to a few more things from yesterday. John Heyman tweeted this yesterday, quote, "Hearing Marlins are out there looking for extra MLB quality players. Obviously, they have a lot of concerns, but one of them is fielding a representative team," end quote. So it's run through the clubhouse. Half the roster has it. They're decimated by COVID. And now they're just looking for bodies just to fill out the roster. And by the way, exactly how safe is it to join the Marlins right now? Who the hell would want to walk into that clubhouse? Who the hell would want to walk into that clubhouse that was just decimated by a COVID outbreak? Ask yourself that. Heyman follows that up with this today. Quote, "Marlins may have a hard time filling out 30-man active roster considering their outbreak of positives. Currently trying to figure out how to make it work since many candidates for call-up are currently not on the 40-man roster. Might have to consider playing with less than 30. And then he chased it with this, quote, "Marlins are considering all sorts of free agents, but those would mostly fill out the taxi squad now as they will need players who are ready and proven negative right away," end quote. Imagine trying to be the person who is racing to sign free agents right about now. Like, hey, I'm calling from the Miami Marlins. Hey, listen, we've got a couple of openings on the roster right now. You want to come on down? Yeah, do it. It's great. hang out in South Beach, play some baseball for a team that hasn't tried to win in years and is in a COVID hotspot and plays in a state that is a COVID hotspot. Half the clubhouse has been wrecked already. It's a hotspot onto itself, and the state's a hotspot. Are you in? Hey, man, what am I missing here? Exactly how are they going to field a legitimate Major League team? And a better question, exactly why would they try to field a Major League team? Can you imagine if the Marlins scramble? What if they scramble and they pull some guys off the street and the scrap heap and they get a roster together and then they have another outbreak? How terrible would that look? It's not just about signing guys to go play for a COVID hotspot in a COVID hotspot. Again, the Nats were supposed to go to Miami to play that weekend series, and they've already voted not to. And I'm not surprised, because if you listen to their manager yesterday, Dave Martinez did not seem at all eager to get down there.
My level of concern went from about an 8 to a 12. This thing really can... You know, it hits home now that, you know, you see, half a team, you know, get infected and go from one city to another. So, I got friends on that Miami team, and it really stinks. Man, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. To see those guys go down like that, you know, it's not good for them. It's not good for anybody. You know, I got guys in our clubhouse that are really concerned as well. And for me, this is my family. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm scared.
All right. So, again, that's the manager of the reigning World Series champs. And that was yesterday, before the news broke today that they're not going, that they voted. So, as a precursor, that's not surprising at all. But that is a manager. Notice that's not a guy saying, hey, you know what? We're assuming the risks. We know what's up. We know somebody's going to get it. That's a guy saying, I'm scared. I was at an 8 concern level wise, and now I'm a 12. And that's the manager of the reigning World Series champs.
I washed my hands. I went from 47 times a day to probably 99 times a day. Wear my mask everywhere I go. So, there's always, there's that concern, You don't know, right now you don't know if, because of my heart condition, what happens, to me if I do get it.
Right. So, again, these comments were made yesterday, and this was before the team voted not to go. So when asked about whether or not he had his doubts about going down to Miami this weekend, again, this was yesterday, but if you listen to what he's saying right here, you pretty much knew that that vote was going to go the way it did this morning.
Hopefully they make the right decision. That's all I'm going to say, it's...
i.e., we're not going. Hopefully they make the right decision. That's all I'm going to say. i.e., we ain't going. But again, it is Major League Baseball's decision. It's not their decision. They voted not to go, but baseball ultimately makes that decision. There's no way they make them go. At the same time, they might say, all right, we're not going to make you go. Of course not. We care about you. We care about your health. You can come to the district. I'm not so sure health officials in D.C. want them coming in. Dodger pitcher David Price tweeted this, quote, now we really get to see if MLB is going to put players' health first. Remember when Manfred said players' health was paramount? Part of the reason I'm at home right now is because the players' health wasn't being put first. I can see that hasn't changed. End quote. That's David Price. He's not wrong. Because it sure doesn't seem like the league is putting the players' health on top of the list of priorities. Not if the response to the outbreak is, it's not that bad. We're okay. It's not a nightmare. Well, why are you okay? Because we have bigger rosters. I can't. How asinine is that argument? Half the roster is gone. Why is it all right? Because we have more players. It's not how big the roster is. It's the fact that half the roster got it. Remember when Tom Verducci asked the commissioner what it would take for a team or a season to shut down? This was the answer.
A team Losing a number of players that rendered it completely non-competitive would be an issue that, we would have to address and have to think about making a change, whether that was shutting down a part of the season, the whole season. That depends on the circumstances. Same thing with respect to league-wide. You know, you get to a certain point league-wide where it does become a health threat, and we certainly would shut down at that point.
I want to reference one thing. If you listen to that very closely, or even if you don't, there was not a single mention in there about the health of the players. If the health is paramount, that probably would have been or should have been part of the answer. But the answer was about if you lose too many players, it wouldn't be competitive. Like, there was no reference to the health of the players. So from that answer, for the commissioner, it's not about the health of the players. It's about the competitiveness of the games. And that tells you pretty much all you need to know. And it's not a baseball thing, not just a baseball thing. Numerous NFL players have announced that they're not going to play this season. Five members of the Patriots, including Dante Hightower. Multiple members of the Cowboys and Ravens. So my point to you is, if your reaction to their decision is anything other than supporting them and understanding that it's a nearly impossible decision and that they're putting their health and their families first, then you probably should take a good long look at yourself. And don't come in here with this junk about COVID being no big deal. Don't come in here with this crap about how it doesn't impact young people or athletes. Red Sox pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez tested positive for COVID. He's got a heart condition now, reportedly as a result of COVID. That's a 27-year-old professional athlete. So don't come in here and tell me that COVID does not impact young people. Again, I'd love to play the commissioner's game and say the glass is half full and that it's just a nightmare start to the season and it's all a bad dream. I mean, I hope that for so many reasons. I really want this to work. But a few days in, I've got some serious freaking concerns. And if you don't have concerns, you might want to rethink your stance. If you don't have concerns, seeing all this, you're just not paying attention. My guest is Luke Walton. Luke, it's great to have you back. Before we get into everything else, Luke, how are you doing and how is life inside of the bubble for you?
Thanks, Jim. Good to be back on your show, too. It's nice to, do things that feel normal with everything that's going on. So appreciate you having me on.
Here, here.
Life in the bubble is, it's good. It's in perspective of where everything else is. In the world right now, we're pretty blessed to be able to be here and try to, you know, be a beacon of light and bring people together by playing basketball, which is a game that we all love coaching and players love playing. So the NBA has done an amazing job of creating this environment here. And it's just it's fun to be able to get back out there on the court with the guys and get back to work a little bit.
Luke Walton's my guest, and Luke, I would echo that. It's good to have you back on the program. Like, it may never be exactly the way it used to be, and it may be a case where there is a new normal, but it's good to do things that you know. Now, you told Mark Medina that the bubble is kind of challenging because, quote, the borders are a little everywhere. I almost walked out the first day I was here. So what was it like when you first arrived and figuring out the lay of the land?
Well, yeah, early on it was, you're adjusting to everything, still trying to get familiar with the area. And since then, it's, I know exactly where the borderline is now. And I purposely don't even get close to it. But, it's very strict as far as it should be. It's very strict as far as trying to keep everybody healthy. And I think the NBA has shown and proven that if a rule gets broken, whether it's on purpose or not, they're going to do what they need to do to make sure that they're protecting the group as a whole. So, the standard has been set, and I think everyone within the bubble is now adjusted to that, and probably a little bit thankful that. That it is what it is, because as the numbers came out the other day, Jim, I'm sure you saw, there's, other than the day people have shown up, there's been no, knock on wood, there's been no positive test out here so far.
Right. And that tells us that the bubble, in fact, works. It works. Now, being in the bubble means, and you point this out, Luke, that there's an adjustment to be made, a lot of adjustments to be made. One of the adjustments is being away from your wife and your kids for an extended period of time. What has that part of it been like for you?
That's definitely the hardest part, and probably the hardest part for everybody. But it's for me personally, it's nice knowing that, you know, my wife has one of her girlfriends out there with her, and she's got her kids. So there's, you know, they're happy where they're at, which makes, you know, we talk a lot about what mental health is going to be like here and the stress of leaving family. But for me personally, knowing that the home life is, they're having fun. They have their own mini bubble going on, but it's with other kids so that they can all play together. That makes my life and my job a lot easier to do, knowing that, yes, I miss them, and that's hard for me personally, but knowing that they're in a good place and they're enjoying themselves.
Luke, I was going to ask you about the mental health. I'm glad you brought that up, because I know that team, your team, has been really proactive when it comes to dealing with the mental health side of things. Why is that so critical, and how do you go about addressing that?
Well, I think I think in the bigger picture, I think it's really an amazing thing that sports in the past few years has really embraced this idea of how important mental health is and what mental health really is. And I think you got to give a lot of love to DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love for kind of being two of the first ones in the NBA to come out and actually talk about it, because for so long, it's been a stigma. It's been, if you talk about it, or if you see a therapist or any of these type of things, it's a sign of weakness. And that's just not the truth. It's part of evolving and growing as humans and people and teammates. So the fact that the whole world is, at least the sports world, is kind of accepting and moving in that direction, I think is great for everybody. But with that, we have to continue to encourage and adopt, those ideas and put into practice, letting our players have people to talk to. So, you know, for us personally, the NBA has professionals out here within the bubble that every team can talk to. We had one of them come speak to our team. Dr. Anderson did a great job and kind of presenting his material and then being available for individuals to reach out to him. A big part of the mental health for me and part of the culture I truly believe in creating is you have the openness with players and coaches to always be able to talk about things and always put things out on the table so that guys aren't just burying stuff, burying stuff down low. And we try to practice that all the time. And then obviously getting just back into our routines, I think, is great for people's mental health and exercising and playing basketball. I think all of that stuff really helps, in the big picture of things as well.
You bet. Sacramento Kings head coach Luke Walton joining me for a few more moments. Luke, I know that when the team started to make preparations to head to Orlando, you had multiple players test positive for COVID. Harrison Barnes tested positive before entering the bubble, but he cleared all the hurdles. He's back now. What does it mean to have him back, and how has he looked?
He looks great, and I felt bad. You know, Harrison did. He took this very seriously, and he was doing everything in his power to isolate within what the rules were being suggested as far as creating his own personal bubble. And he was working, he was working his tail off the whole time that the NBA shut down. So, I felt awful for him, and I know he had to go through some stuff. But having him back out here for our team and what he means to our team, just as far as the comfort that the guys have with him, the player he is, the versatility he provides us on the court, the confidence he provides our group off the court is huge. So, one of the things we talk about, Jim, like preparing for the bubble, was we have to be ready for anything. And by anything, I mean something's going to happen that we're not even thinking of right now, and we have to be able to adapt and adjust. And one of those things is with the coronavirus, you don't know how long. I mean, some people test positive for, I've read some cases up to 40-something days. So you just don't know who you're going to get, when they're going to come back, what kind of shape they're going to be in. But all that being said, Harrison showed up and looked way better than I would have anticipated after being quarantined for that long.
Sacramento Kings head coach Luke Walton joining us once again. So, Luke, what about Friday night? You've got the Spurs in the first of the seeding games. How do you go about approaching that game?
You know, well, it's cliche, but it is what it is. It's one game at a time. You know, it's an eight. The way we put it to our teammates, it's an eight-game tournament. And we have to take one at a time. And obviously those games aren't, you know, they're all very important. Some are more important than others. And I think trying to get off to a good quick start will build that rhythm for whatever team ends up making that run to try to get the 9 seed. And Friday night for us is, you know, it's a huge game for us and San Antonio. So we're prepping for it like any other game. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of nerves, a lot of stress similar to a playoff feeling. One, because we haven't played in so long. And two, it's only 8 games. It's not really a lot of opportunity to make up ground. So you got, you know, we gotta be ready to really execute and give everything we have to try to get that one.
You know, look, it's so different. I mean, it's so different for everybody, but it's so different than what everybody's accustomed to. What's it been like to have games without fans and coaching in a different environment than what you're used to?
You know, I've talked to the players about it, and for me personally, I don't know. You know, I can't speak for other coaches. It the first game was definitely strange, but as we've gone into, you know, 2 more games since then, there's a couple really awkward silences that happen throughout the game that you kind of realize there's no fans there. And obviously we'd much rather prefer to play with the fans and that energy that happens. But when I'm coaching the game and talking to the players and that they're on the court, the guys that are on the court, and you're lost in that competition and that battle and trying to plan for what's coming next and what's happening now. A lot of the times you forget that there's not even a crowd there. So that's been a little easier of an adjustment than I thought it would be. And even into this last scrimmage we just played last night, the NBA did a nice job of, like, now whatever the home team is, like in the fourth quarter, they turn the fan noise up even louder when the Clippers made a shot, or so they're making little, you know, little tweaks to it to make it even feel more like a normal game.
Finally, Rashawn Holmes is back. He had to serve a quarantine for crossing the campus line to pick up a food delivery. So what kind of conversations did you have with him, and how has it been to have him back?
He's huge for us. I mean, he's a big part of what we do. And, you know, it goes back to having those honest talks. And was it fair? Was it this? Was it that? Hey, it is what it is. It's the rules. And I understand it was a mistake. But, you know, the message to not only him but the whole team is accountability. And what we're doing here is bigger than just us. It's trying to bring – you know, basketball, sports in general, it inspires people. It brings people together. And we're trying to do that in the time that the whole world needs it. And if we're going to violate rules or put others at risk, we're letting ourselves down. We're letting our teammates down because now we miss Rashawn for 10 days. And ultimately, if something were to happen in the bubble and they had to shut this whole thing down, we're letting everybody down. So there's a lot of responsibility with us as individuals right now. And it was, you know, we're not mad. We're just, you know, it's a learning point. And Rashawn's been great. And since he's been back on the court, he's really helped us the last few days.
I'm going to go ahead and end this, Luke, by the same way you started it, by saying it's good to have some normal. He is the head coach of the Sacramento Kings. First season there, Sacramento 3.5 back of Memphis. They've got a big one against San Antonio on Friday night in Orlando. Great to have you, Luke. Good luck this weekend, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jim. Good talking to you.
I mentioned my man used to call the program back in the day. He's a 1992 Olympian. He is Bob Samuelson. Bob, brother, what's going on? How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. How are you doing? Actually, I know better. I know you're doing well, but thank you for asking. I'm doing great.
It's good to have you, man. So it's been a long time. Well, I mean, you'll call occasionally, but what brings you back to the jungle today and right before a tea time?
It was just funny. I was driving over to Rancho, and by the way, that was supposed to be a secret. I'm skipping out of work, but oops. Don't worry. It's not like you don't have millions of listeners.
My bad. Sorry,
right
bro.
After the 92 games, that Oakley story killed me. So we were playing some exhibition tour against Japan at Madison Square Garden, like in September of 92. And it was like an afternoon game, and we ended up winning in five. We had this promoter kind of did it, and we had like 9,000 fans. We had just a great game. We ended up winning. Afterwards, a teammate of mine, Brian Ivey, did some kind of like interview type, presser type deal downstairs. Upstairs, I forget. But anyway, we go down, and somehow we get our hands on a few beers while we're doing the presser and afterwards. So we go to get escorted out by security, and we go to get into the elevator, and who walks in but Oakley. And so it's me, Brian, security guard, and Oakley in the elevator. And it's pregame for them. They had a game. We had an afternoon match. They had an evening game. So he's coming there pregame, and he's wearing just some fantastic gear. So we're in there. The security guard makes introductions. He's very polite, but he's not the friendliest of cats. Like, you know, anyway, he was just polite, says, hi, nice to meet you. And we had a couple beers, and I don't know what came over me, but I reach out and I grab it by the lapel of his jacket, and I did in my best Eddie Murphy from Coming to America.
Oh, dude.
I did, this is beautiful. What is this, velvet?
Oh,
and
dude.
It was one of those decisions that I just immediately regretted. And I thought he was going to punch me through the elevator door. He was like clearly confused on how to respond, but obviously was not digging it. There's like 15 seconds of uncomfortable silence. Elevator doors open. I have no idea if this is the floor we're supposed to get on out on, but Ivy and I just bounce out of the elevator.
Incredible.
And away they go. And Ivy just looks at me. He's like, you're an idiot. And I'm like, yeah, obviously. I don't know what came over me. So,
dude, that's incredible.
The moral of the story is, yeah. Oak doesn't play.
Now, that's amazing. And Bob, you're not a small guy either. You're not a small guy, but I mean, anybody can read another guy, and you know when a guy's not happy. You don't want to touch that guy or his gear.
Oh my gosh! That was a bad call on my part. You know, one of many. But
dude,
you
live to talk about it. What a great story, man! I appreciate that. Sorry to give you up. Always good to have you on the show. Appreciate you, man. That was awesome.
Thank you so much. Well, take care, Jim.
Yeah, you too, Bob.
Good night, now.